supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. A preliminary report examining Delaware prisons following a deadly February uprising found lots of problems with the Department of Correction. WHYY's Mark Eichmann reports.
The report found widespread dysfunction within the Delaware Department of Correction. If not fixed, these issues will, quote, continue to provide fertile ground for chaos and violence in the facility, it said. Those issues include a lack of good training, poor communication, allowing gang members to share the same cell. It also found prison rules were not enforced consistently. Former Delaware Attorney General Charles Oberle is one of the report's authors. He says the inmates they interviewed were upset with that inconsistency.
They want consistency in the enforcement of the rules, and they realize that some people are going to be strict, but just follow what your rules are so that we know day-to-day what we can do and what we can't do.
Communication during the hostage crisis that left one prison guard dead was so poor that there were three separate command posts operating simultaneously. The report says at one point the Vaughn warden threatened to shoot down a drone that Wilmington police had flown over the prison at the request of state police. The warden, who was later suspended and had since been reassigned, erroneously thought the drone was being operated by the news media. The report was a disappointment for Reverend Christopher Bullock, who leads the Delaware Coalition of Prison Reform and Justice. His group has called for a federal investigation into allegations of mistreatment of prisoners at the hands of guards.
It does not mention the alleged misconduct, violations of human and civil rights by some of the correction officers. It does not address the pain of the people who have family members who are accusing and alleging torture by some correction officers in the prison.
The report found that most workers at the prison were focused solely on surviving the day so they could return home safely. That led to nearly all prison employees just doing their own thing rather than following a unified strategy for managing the prison. A full report will be issued in August. From the Delaware Desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
As widely anticipated, President Donald Trump yesterday announced that the United States is pulling out of the Paris Climate Change Accord. It's a good time to take up public attitudes around protecting the environment with Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. Hi, Frank.
Hello, Dave.
Frank, how does his decision resonate with the public?
You know, it depends on who you look at. I like to look at the overall American public, Dave, and by who you look at, I mean everybody or Republicans. The bottom line is if he's appealing or wants to appeal only to the Republican base, then he is resonating with a number of Republicans who are much less concerned about the environment or climate change than is the case for independents or Democrats. If, as I think is the case or should be the case, we want to look at overall majority public opinion, we clearly see a trend towards Americans being more and more concerned about the environment and climate change. There has been some polling, not by Gallup, but there was a Yale polling last year as an example that asked Americans explicitly about pulling out of the Paris Climate Treaty, and overwhelmingly the majority said that the United States should not. So that's some direct evidence. Indirect evidence, we have a number of questions. Americans this year have become more concerned about the environment in the past, more concerned about global warming, more likely to be saying the U.S. is doing too little about the environment. This is a very political issue over time. It became politicized, climate change in particular, back in the 2000s, and we saw Republicans increasingly less likely to believe in climate change over time, which is quite interesting, but now they're coming back some more to be concerned about it. And we have, with Trump in office, Democrats and independents are more likely now to be concerned about it, and Republicans are edging up a little. Dave, we have a couple of trade-off questions, which I think are very interesting, where we ask the Americans, what's more important, paying attention to the environment or economic growth? And then we say, what's more important, paying attention to the environment or the traditional production of oil, gas, and other fuels of that ilk? In both instances, we have a majority saying the environment trumps economic growth and the environment trumps the production of traditional fuel.
Though, is the environment considered a greater priority for Americans than the economy?
The environment in our most recent update is up there with the economy. Now, it depends on how you ask about it. We gave Americans a long list of things, and actually health care was at the top domestically. And then there were a bunch of issues that were right below that when we rated them one by one, and the environment was part of that group right under health care. However, when we ask Americans, which we do every month, what's the most important problem facing the country, very few people spontaneously say climate change or the environment. They have other concerns at the top of their minds, and that may be because we say, what's the most important problem facing the country now? And a lot of Americans don't think of climate change because the effects may be longer term than right now.
Frank, lastly, I understand Gallup has tapped into perceptions about the origins of mankind.
Something we've been asking for a long time. 38% of Americans now say that man, that is humans, were created essentially as they are today, as in the book of Genesis, about 10,000 years ago. That's a creationist view of the origin of humans. Most biologists and anthropologists, of course, tell us that man evolved over the many, many millions of years, and about 38% of Americans will say, yes, humans evolved, but God guided the process, and then another 19% say that humans evolved, but there was actually no guidance from a divine being at all. But I want to come back to that 38% who have the creationist view. Again, humans created 10,000 years ago, essentially in their current form, didn't evolve. That's down. We had at one point almost half, 47% of Americans, who said that the creationist view is how they looked at the origin of humans, and that was as recently as 1999. So we're down to 38% now. Still a big number, a lot of scientists would say, but clearly kind of going along with some other declining indicators of religiosity, lower than it has been in the past.
Thanks, Frank.
You bet, Dave.
Frank Newport, editor-in-chief at the Gallup Poll. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight. Penn State President Eric Barron says the university will become a national leader in reforming the college fraternity and sorority system. This comes after the hazing-related death of sophomore Timothy Piazza at the Beta Theta Pi fraternity. In a special meeting, Penn State trustees unanimously accepted a slate of new safety measures and regulations for Greek life. Reforms include zero tolerance for hazing involving alcohol or physical or mental risk to students. A Greek monitoring committee, parent education about Greek life, and a fee per member to pay for police services and spot checks of fraternities. Barron says Penn State will deal with disciplinary issues in the Greek system instead of students.
Central to this is university control of the Greek misconduct process. Essentially, we are removing IFC and Panhellenic controls on evaluation and adjudication of misbehavior.
He also says a new mandatory education program might require students entering a Greek organization to read the grand jury presentment detailing the death of Timothy Piazza. In recent months, Pittsburgh has struggled with water issues, including concerns about lead in its water, big water main breaks, and a boil water advisory. But it's hardly the only Pennsylvania city struggling to keep its water system healthy. Keystone Crossroads' Margaret J. Krause reports.
Pittsburgh Mayor Bill Peduto told a packed council chambers earlier this spring that the city's water system faced significant risk.
Over a half dozen areas, if they are to fail, there is no backup in this entire city without water. Over a half dozen areas where if one thing goes wrong, the entire city is without water.
That sounds bad, but Pittsburgh isn't alone. Lisa Daniels is the director of Pennsylvania's Bureau of Safe Drinking Water. She estimates 30% of the state's water systems aren't as resilient as they need to be.
So that could mean they don't have backup power supply, they may not have adequate finished water storage, they may not have interconnections that would allow them to purchase water from somebody else if something would go wrong in their system.
And something almost certainly will. Strengthening systems so they can withstand breaks, failures, and emergencies means finding even more money.
They just now need to begin to think about how resiliency plays into that, and they have to put it on their priority list.
There hasn't been a clear priority list in Pittsburgh for almost 20 years. That's according to Bob Weimer, interim director of the Pittsburgh Water and Sewer Authority, or PWSA, Weimer thinks the mayor's concern is warranted.
The public should go away with the idea that, yes, we need to make investment, and it's not a short-term, immediate fix. It's going to be a long-term investment in the system.
Weimer says part of the problem is, historically, the authority has failed to make that kind of investment.
We should be spending over $100 million a year in replacement or upgrade or reconditioning, and we're not.
And haven't. In fact, Weimer says plans for Pittsburgh's water system long ago called for backup pipes to protect against the kind of compounding failures happening today.
They were planned, but never built. So it's not that we didn't have the thought that it was needed, but we didn't have the commitment to financing, to raising the rates necessary to meet the investments.
Water systems across the state and the country have seen declining investment, like in Harrisburg, where Shannon Gordy is CEO of Capital Region Water. She says less money was spent on water systems because for a long time, they just worked.
I like to say that our industry did such a good job that we've put ourselves in this position because we were out of sight, out of mind. Many political figures based their budgets on not wanting to raise rates, being proud of having not raised water and sewer rates in a decade or more.
When budgets really get tight, Gordy says preventive maintenance is the first thing to go out the door. That, coupled with aging infrastructure, means there's this big disconnect. Gordy says people want and expect clean water, but they're not willing to pay for it.
I understand not everybody thinks about water every day. That's our job at the water utilities. But we need our constituents to know just enough to put the right value on these systems so that we can get done what we need to get done.
Some cities are farther along than others. The Philadelphia Water Department, for example, annually replaces more than 28 miles of water mains. The city's water commissioner, Deborah McCarty, hopes to see that number go up to 40 miles a year.
We have a long-standing history of reinvesting in our infrastructure.
Philly is one of the largest water systems in the state, with the budgets to match. In fiscal year 2018, the department will invest more than $350 million in the water and sewer systems, as well as $750 million on operations, including some serious maintenance. But for cities that don't have that track record of reinvestment, McCarty's advice is to monitor and maintain. Plan carefully, spend judiciously.
You know, any money you spend, particularly if it's not yours, it's the ratepayers, you spend it just in time, so just before it breaks. And, you know, we try to be really good at that. We're not always.
Preventive maintenance is the ideal, but it's not always possible. In Pittsburgh, they've had to take a fix-as-fail approach, according to Interim Director Bob Weimer. Not because they want to. It's inconvenient and expensive. But like many cities, Pittsburgh faces decades of backlog. A process is underway to restructure the city's water and sewer authority so it can better manage its debt and make necessary investments. Margaret J. Krause, Keystone Crossroads.
Keystone Crossroads is a statewide public media initiative reporting on challenges facing Pennsylvania cities. WHYY serves as the lead station. Las Parcelas is a community garden that for decades has served as a cultural hub for Latinos in Philadelphia's West Kensington section. It will be the host for the city's fourth annual Community Gardens Day, June 15th. But Las Parcelas is facing a moment of change. Neighborhood real estate values have grown more than 90% in 6 years, and that's changing the neighborhood. Higher rents are also pushing older residents farther away, many of them from Puerto Rican families. What effect would that have on a garden that's rooted in Puerto Rican culture? Catalina Jaramillo of WHYY's Plan Philly reports.
Ana Montañez has been gardening a Las Parcelas for 4 years.
We're growing lettuces. We have onions, broccoli.
She first visited the gardens to hear traditional Puerto Rican music, bomba y plena, and immediately felt at home.
I'm Puerto Rican, but I was born here. But as a child, I've always traveled back. And so it brought back a lot of memories of visiting my family up in the mountains and stuff like that.
One of the magic spots of the garden is a little house called La Casita de las Abuelas, or Grandma's House. La Casita looks like a rural house in Puerto Rico, and it feels like a tiny museum. It's filled with objects brought from Puerto Rico, musical instruments, books, and utensils. And it has a small bedroom with an old bed, vintage dresses, and handmade dolls.
Every single object is here. It's to tell a story, to remember who we are. where we came from.
Edith Brown personally collected most of these objects.
This was my mother's.
She's a strong 70-year-old lady with a contagious laugh. She created Las Parcelas in the late 1980s with Tomasita Romero and a group of Puerto Rican women called Grupo Motivos. Romero is thin, with white hair, and she exudes elegance. She's 85 now, and she's been losing her memory.
My memories have gone. Don't get old.
But there's one thing she remembers well of those years.
Oh, my goodness. We had drugs in every step, everywhere, every corner.
Businesses and neighbors who could were moving out, and they were losing their families to drug violence and jail.
We were losing hope, and people were suffering, and we were tired.
Instead of despairing, Brown and Romero, who everyone in the neighborhood calls Iris and Tomasita, went to work on a garden they thought could help.
I believe that a garden is the solution for anything.
With a continuous grant from the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society, and with a lot of work, they transformed more than 30 scattered lots into 6 award-winning gardens.
We didn't sleep. This became our life.
They started by cleaning vacant lots and building raised beds. La Casita, the grandmother's house, and an open kitchen soon followed. Next, they organized festivals with bands and dancers.
The festivals. Everybody from the community came because we didn't have anything else. This was the place. This was the place.
Women in the neighborhood no longer were isolated in their homes. They spent most of the day in the gardens, talking and sharing stories, while cultivating pigeon peas and chiles, cooking dishes from their home countries, and teaching their kids how to grow food. Brown says the gardens brought life back into the neighborhood by honoring their culture first.
Nobody was thinking horticulture in this community when everybody was in pain. We needed the colors, and we needed the dance and the music and the food and the companionship. That's what we know.
Brown and Romero stopped tending the gardens about a decade ago.
Yeah, that's Iris. This is Iris as well.
The Norris Square Neighborhood Project now manages them.
Two other women, Grupo Motivos.
Justin Tresa is the group's executive director.
Everyone talks about creative placemaking nowadays, yet, you know, these were things that these women were doing without having a, you know, term.
When Las Parcelas was created on abandoned lots, losing the land was not an issue. Tresa says today it's a different story.
In the last 2 months, I've had two or three different developers contact us about our lots.
The zip code where the gardens are has seen home prices rise 90% over 6 years. Older residents fear displacement. The neighborhood project owns roughly half of the lots the gardens occupy. Most of the remaining lots are owned by the Philadelphia Redevelopment Authority. The city says it's working to secure the land, and the Neighborhood Gardens Trust, a nonprofit that helps preserve gardens, is helping. But what about the culture rooted in the gardens?
The butterfly garden.
Las Parcelas.
Las Parcelas. Raíces. El Jardín de la Paz. Y el Colobo.
The Neighborhood Project has been training and hiring local Latino high school kids to work in the garden. The group is called Raíces del Cambio, or Roots of Change.
This is the mural of the community heroes, and these are the 6 ladies that started the gardens.
Bianca Maldonado says the gardens mean a lot to her.
Not only does it represent my culture, but we have a lot of our events hosted here in La Parcelas, so a lot of memories are built here. Honestly, I can say I love this because you see everything growing and everything, and then at the end of it, you get to eat what you grew.
For the Roots of Change crew, there's no doubt that the gardens will grow into the future.
Well, we're going to continue the legacy. We're already doing that as we speak. If we make a stand, if we actually like have people hear us, let them know that we're here and we're not going to go anywhere, that they can't take it away from us because this is our home.
Catalina Jaramillo, WHYY News.
That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, Ty Johnson, and Brett Rader. At the helm this week, Al Banks, Charlie Kyer, and Diana Martinez. Sandra Clark is Vice President of News and Civic Dialogue. John Musoni is Assistant Vice President for News Operations, and our news director is Eugene Son. Thanks for joining us, and have a great weekend. I'm Dave Heller for NewsWorks Tonight.